Whatever the adventure, there's a BMW engineered to take it on. The X3 delivers a striking design with agile performance. The 100% electric i4, packed with pure electric energy. Or the plug-in hybrid X5, an impressive, versatile SUV granting full control on every journey. Choose what powers your next adventure during the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine. Hurry in for exceptional offers through January 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
I saw Billy Squire one time at the old Checker Dome. I think he was warming up for Pat Benatar or something like that. But I like a little Billy Squire now and again, ladies and gentlemen. The KC Classic for you. We had another one that we referenced earlier. Michael Brewer of Brewer and Shipley, he of One Toke Over the Line, passed away a couple of days ago at the age of 80. So it looks like they have a new spending bill in Washington, but I love this cut from Senator John Kennedy.
I saw what you saw. I mean, it's a multiple vehicle pileup. I knew as soon as I saw the bill it was going to be trouble. The thing was as big as a Costco.
Oh, my God. I love that guy. I hope he never goes away. He provides half of the show open cuts for me here at 97.1 FM Talk. Our friend Dwayne Patterson, who writes at HotAir.com, host of the Dwayne's World podcast, is with us to talk about the very latest. There's been activity this afternoon, hasn't there, Dwayne?
Yeah, you know, it's a good time to be on the air at Afternoon Drive because there's actually stuff to talk about, isn't there? Hi, Mark, how you doing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm interviewing Carl Cannon a couple hours ago, and like in the middle of that, Twitter blows up with this new deal that's slightly shorter than 1,500 pages, isn't it?
It comes in at 116 pages, and they've scheduled a vote tonight. They've already put it out there, and so far, outside of just a handful of characters. Which I think is just posturing. But, you know, I'm starting to do the head count and the math, and I'm feeling confident it's actually going to pass tonight. And just from a tactical standpoint, you know, we can talk about the debt ceiling and all the other stuff that's either in it or out of it. And that's all well and fine. But just from the optics of this, let's say the House does put this thing together and gives Trump basically what he wants, which is a 2-year window of maneuvering room to be able to do what he said he was going to do. And if it doesn't work in 2 years, all is lost anyway, because the Republicans are going to get killed in the midterm.
Right. That's probably true. Yeah.
So, you know, they're giving him his 2-year window basically. And if they pass that in the House, then it goes over to the Senate. And Chuck Schumer, the only leverage he had against Donald Trump in the new year, was trying to hamstring him right out of the gate with a debt ceiling that was looming, and that was his negotiating tool. Now he can't go along with this, but if he says no and the Senate Democrats scuttle it, whatever happens with the shutdown, it's totally on them.
But you're saying this is where some of this gets confusing. My understanding was, you know, Trump was insisting on a clean CR, dropping all the pork and stuff like that. But he also wanted the debt ceiling. He even said, I think that there shouldn't be any limit possibly in a debt ceiling. Chip Roy and others like, no, we're not going to do that. So what's that all about, that negotiation back and forth? I think Carl said, look, some of this he wants to tag with the Biden administration, but I am a little confused on the debt ceiling stuff.
Art of the deal, baby. Art of the deal. So what Trump was going for is he's shooting the moon. I want the debt ceiling gone forever. Chip Roy is like, well, absolutely not. Elizabeth Warren is saying, oh, yeah, we want that, too, because one day we'll be back in power and we would love to be able to run up the debt. Oh, you bet. So you have all the predictable voices saying the predictable things. But when they actually got down to it, what they're giving him is a 2-year window for Doge and the Trump administration to have some maneuvering room to do what they said they were going to do and cut costs without completely dealing with a debt ceiling and paralysis. So if he gets his 2-year window, and by the way, Donald Trump, when this new deal got proposed, he's all on board with it. He's like, great, give me 2 years. I think we can fix the problems we have. All he wanted was to negotiate for maneuvering room, and he got that. And if you look at the current House makeup right now, It's a 219 to 211 Republican majority in the current lame duck session of Congress. There's five vacancies, remember. You've got Matt Gaetz that's gone. You've got Adam Schiff, who is now going to join the Senate. You've got Elise Stefanik, who's, I mean, there's five vacancies. So that means that the pass threshold is now down to 216, except Nancy Pelosi, who busted her hip in Italy, pulling a Joe Biden.
Oh, yeah, I did hear about that. Is she in the hospital over there?
No, she just flew back home. Okay. She's in California nursing this bad hip. They don't get to vote by proxy anymore, and they don't get to vote in absentia anymore. So she's not going to be in D.C. to cast this vote. So that's one more vacancy. So now the pass rate is at 215. So the Republicans can lose four people. I know there's Bob Good out there who is a contrarian. I know Chip Roy is acting like he wants to be a no. But my guess is by the time they actually hold that vote, he doesn't want to be out on that ledge by himself.
Well, with Chip Roy, I don't know. I think he would be the guy that would want to be, but I understand your point. I want to go back to Senator Kennedy just for a second here and want to get your reaction because I want to kind of focus on Mike Johnson and how he's managed this.
I'm not criticizing anybody. But Mike's problem is on the Republican side of the aisle over there. He's got some free-range chickens, and they wander off, and he can't catch up with them. And there's only one person right now who can catch them. And that's Donald Trump.
A little hard to hear the audio, but he goes, I love that guy, by the way. He says there's
the free-range chickens.
Free-range chickens. Yeah, he's got free-range chickens. So, but, you know, I guess he would be talking about Chip Roy and some of the others, but the free-range chickens are kind of trying to stand up for what the American people might have voted for here, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. And here is what Trump's problem is, okay? So you've got the Northeast Republicans, the Mike Lawlers, and those people who he supports. And people that voted those center-right Republicans into office that also voted for Trump. Okay, so Trump's people, they want the salt cap lifted, and they want that restored. The rest of the country doesn't, but they do. And he needs those people because those congressmen are representing people that did vote for Trump. On the other hand, in the middle of the country, the Farm Belt, the farmers have taken it in the shorts for the last, you know, few years of Joe Biden's politics. They voted for Trump because they want a little help too. So they want a clean farm bill. They want the ethanol stuff. The rest of the country sure doesn't. But those people voted for Trump too, so they want their piece. So there's a lot of different factions, and Trump can't just blanket say, "I know all of you people voted for me, and you love me. But now you're going to have to give me this, you're going to have to give me that, you're going to have to sacrifice everything that you guys want individually in your own districts." That's only going to go for so long.
Yeah, look, point that you're making here is so important, and I try to hammer this home every once in a while, too. Everybody wants, you know, Republicans to have a backbone and be on the same side. But as you know, you're in California.
This is a republic.
Right. The California Republicans,
you gotta give a little to get a little.
They're different in California and New York and, you know, in Wisconsin, probably compared to Missouri and Arkansas and, you know, Louisiana. So there's a lot of voices. Let's talk about salt real quick here, because that is the state and local taxes that you can deduct. And that's what, capped at 10,000 now. So they're talking about an increase in that. And that's one of the negotiating points.
Yes. And the way I'm reading it, and I'm certainly not a green visor guy, but the way I'm reading it is they're talking about boosting it from 10 to 30,000, which would in short form kind of means test it a little bit. The people that really need it can get it in the middle and lower middle income class level. But upper end people won't get the same benefit. And that's probably OK. And if you means test it so that you boost the threshold so that it helps, the people that really could use the help, that are red state voters living in a blue state that are kind of hosed by their own governance, like
right.
Me in California.
Well, because let's explain why that is, because you're talking to an audience in a very, well, kind of split, but a very low property tax state, Missouri, for the most part. I lived in Wisconsin. It's very different, right? Illinois is very different. Now, we have something here called personal property tax. So we always have to pay every year on our cars. And if you own a goat, I do not own a goat, but I think you have to pay on your farm animals as well. But the point is in New Jersey, or California, Wisconsin, some people, you might pay $8,000 a year here for property tax. It might be double that in some of these states.
Right. That's exactly right. By the way, is Sue a goat owner? She looks like a goat owner.
But she could probably tell you that, but she's on vacation this week. It's a very good question. I'm not sure. I will get with her on Monday, but good question because she actually took the week off. So this is all very complicated, but it does appear like Trump's trying to get some things done. He's negotiating in his way. The question for me would be, are we really going to go through another deal here where Mike Johnson's going to be booted out and we're going to have to pick another speaker?
Well, the short answer is nobody knows. The educated guess is you have to get down to who wants the gig, if not him. I know there's lots of parlor talk amongst regime media voices saying, "Oh, he's gonna bring in Vivek Ramaswamy. He'll be elected speaker, or Elon Musk will be elected speaker." That's just garbage. That's nonsense.
I love what people say. One of my favorite things is from a few years ago is that Trump's going to be Speaker of the House, right? Well, I guess he can't technically constitutionally can be, right? I'm like, he doesn't want that job. For people to think that he wanted that job, because you actually have to work at that job. I mean, that's a pretty tricky job. I think we're finding that out right now as well.
It's exactly what John Kennedy said. It's like, you know, trying to cage the free range chicken.
It is.
Nobody really wants the gig when it all comes down to it. You know, it's like the cook car in the old railroad train. When you didn't like what was cooked for dinner and you complained about it, you got to be the cook the next night. Nobody wants that gig. So I think Mike Johnson's probably going to skate out from under this pretty well. He's playing the hand he's dealt, which is not a wonderful hand. But he pretty much gave Trump what he wanted, and now he's daring the House Republicans to say no to it. I don't think they're going to find four or five voices against it. There might be, but I doubt it. And then it goes to the Senate, and Chuck Schumer has now got to walk the plank, and that's going to be just wonderful to watch.
Let me kind of take Dwayne Patterson is here with hotair.com. He hosts the Dwayne's World podcast. Let me take you into the direction of media. You no doubt read the Wall Street Journal reporting on Joe Biden, which has been a long time coming. Of course, it wasn't going to come from the New York Times or the Washington Post. Pretty good detailed reporting on, people ignoring all these signs in the mainstream media, but finally doing some reporting on the things that happened with Biden in the last few years. So did you see this video? I'm going to play a little audio. Did you see Chris Saliza on this today?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
All right. This is on. So here he is, former CNN reporter that says this.
As a reporter, I have a confession to make. I should have pushed harder earlier for more information about Joe Biden's mental and physical well-being and any signs of decline.
You
so
think?
Let me explain.
No, I'm not going to let him explain. But finally, Chris Saliza is realizing this, right? That he should have pressed more. I'll play a little bit more here.
And I think that impacted me at some level. Because while I did ask the question from time to time of, you know, not directly the White House, but aides and people around in that orbit, I didn't really push on it. If I'm being honest.
Yeah, well, why not? That's your job, right? That's your job as a reporter. I think we know the answer. That's a rhetorical question. But I thought that was just a gem here from Mr. Saliza.
This scandal, and it is a scandal,
is
the biggest scandal in American politics this century thus far. The cover up of Joe Biden's
decline. Dude, I agree with you. I completely agree.
They all knew it. And for Chris Saliza, sure, he can cry the crocodile tears now and say, you know, oh, I should have done more reporting. Boy, I'm so sorry. And you know how I'm going to atone for that sin? I'm going to cover Trump every day. I'm going to double down and hold the president accountable. And if I see one slip from him, I'm going to be the first one to report it. That's how he's going to atone for it. I mean, shut up.
It is a joke. And then there's some interesting media headlines today. Did you see Cavuto is stepping out at Fox?
He's
been there for 28 years.
28 yeah. years, right? I mean, yeah. it's not like he got cheated. And the thing about Neil, I've always kind of had a soft spot for Neil because being in that kind of a high profile position, doing this kind of a gig, I mean, you're in media, you know what it's like. Try doing what you do every day with MS. That's not an easy thing to do, right?
No, absolutely. No, very, very tough. You know, the other thing in Hot Air is reporting this. John Sexton wrote about this. I guess a lot of people are being asked to take pay cuts. This has been happening in the media, even in local media, for, I'd say, a couple of decades, certainly 15 years at this point. But they're talking about the difference in ratings between, you know, MSNBC and Fox and CNN, talking about how our friend Joy Reid might have to take a pay cut, too. Wouldn't that be sad, Dwayne?
It's going to be delicious to behold. I'll tell you that the fun cut was Dick Durbin in the Senate hall talking to Manu Raju of CNN when the previous CR, the big omnibus that was DOA, basically, once everybody started peeking into it. So Manu Raju sticks a microphone in Dick Durbin's face and said, there's a bunch of pay hikes in here for senators. Are you sure this is a good time to be trying to jam this thing through? And Dick Durbin looks at him and says, what? Well, that's news to me. Yeah. I didn't know that was in there. But then Manu presses him on it, and Dick Durbin gets ticked. He goes back at Manu Raju and says, well, you're getting more money. Everybody at CNN has been getting more money lately, and nobody's watching you guys. Why should we be any different? So now you've got left-on-left crime going on. It's like pass the popcorn.
Okay. I don't know how I missed that, but I now have it.
I don't know either.
I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed, especially because he's in Illinois. But I'm sending that to Ethan right now, and I do this little segment called Audio Cut of the Day. We may have to pull that up for that. That's very interesting. Dick Durbin, give me a break. You know, did you hear, you know, I thought there was great, great hearings on, you know, some of this stuff with trans sports, and the head of the NCAA goes up there. Did you pay attention to some of that stuff yesterday?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So then here's what Durbin says at that, which is hilarious.
How many athletes are there in the United States in NCAA schools?
510,000.
How many transgender athletes are you aware of?
Less than 10.
Less than 10? Yep. Out of 510,000?
Yeah, yep. So, you know, sort of trying to indicate that that doesn't matter. This is a small issue. It doesn't affect anyone. Meantime, you have, you know, Leah Thomas standing full naked with a penis next to Riley Gaines and some other athletes. So I don't care if there's one person involved, quite honestly, as the father of a 10-year-old daughter. I really don't. It needs to be solved, and that's something that 98% of the American people agree on.
Look, if you know, I'm going to play on a football field where I'm operating between the 20s. So I've got sixty yards of the field covered and under my control, or actually maybe even 75 yards. And the Democrats want to stake out, you know, from the goal line to the 5-yard line on either side of the field, and that's going to be their turf, and they're going to try and sell that message with the American people. I'm willing to have that football game. I'm willing to have that fight.
I am too, because I think the odds would certainly be in our favor.
It's an 80-20, 90-10 issue, right?
Yeah, absolutely is. Dwayne, always great to have you on. You have a great Christmas. I'm guessing it's going to be a little warmer in California than here in Missouri, though we're not in bad shape today. We were in the kind of the 40s and the 50s the last couple of days.
And we're going to dip down into the high 40s, low 50s tonight, and it's movie night. I have a 10-foot Frosty the Snowman inflatable in my front yard with a projector on it, and we're watching all the old claymation movies and having movie night in my front yard.
That's amazing. Is that something that you invite the neighbors over in the whole neighborhood?
Block party. Yep, absolutely.
Awesome.
Block party.
Will you do me a favor, and I'm serious, will you send me a couple of pictures of that or a video later tonight?
You bet.
I'm curious about it. Thank you, Dwayne Patterson. Merry Christmas. Thank you.
You as well.
All right, we'll see you. Audio cut of the day coming up before the hour is up. We have a roundtable tomorrow. It's going to be a good one. A lot to talk about. I started the show with this. This is crazy. You have now the county clerk in St. Louis County that's being charged with a felony because they're alleging Wesley Bell and Sam Page is alleging that she, I guess doctored the paperwork of Dennis Hancock when he was, I don't even know what the allegation is, just ridiculous. Dennis is a St. Louis County councilman. He tried to hire his stepdaughter, I think it was, and then they tried to kick him off the council, and this thing just accelerated because Wesley Bell's office took it to a grand jury yesterday. So it's nuts. We're going to talk about it on the roundtable tomorrow. Also tomorrow, all the regular stuff from the 4 o'clock hour, my friend Paul Hall in entertainment. We got Cusimano here. Ian Scher on some tech stuff and our music. Journalist Tim Sommer will be here as well. I found this in Real Clear Investigations a couple of weeks ago, and some other people have written in the aftermath of John Murawski's investigation about civics. It seems like civics is making a comeback in higher education. Now, when I hear that, I'm a little nervous, but maybe we can turn some of this around with the left-wing indoctrination. John Rogowski is with us this afternoon. Hi, John. How are you? Welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So this is, now when we're, let's define civics first and foremost, because we're not talking about high school here. You're kind of focusing on higher education, right?
Right. So civics in higher ed may include some of those elements that you think about, like, you know, branches of government and the history of the country, but it dwells much more into the underlying intellectual ideas that give rise to the institutions and the debates of the time. So you're reading the Federalist Papers, you're reading John Locke, you're reading John Stuart Mill, you're reading, you know, basically philosophers and political philosophers and moral philosophers and related works, rather than just, you know, blackboard lessons about branches of government.
I guess. And so, yeah. I guess I might say, you know, it's been a little while since I've been in college. I'm like, gosh, I didn't know all of that went away.
Well, you know, it never completely goes away, but it recedes into, you know, hidden corners of the universe. So if you, you know, if you go to the right college, if you find the right professor, you can take these kinds of classes, but they're not mandatory. They're not widespread. They're not universal. And so you have to work to find them. There are certain places dedicated just for the proliferation of these ideas, like, for example, Hillsdale College, which is a private university, takes no government funding, and that's all they do. But they're not really integrated into a university. So you have basically, you know, Hillsdale College is largely, you know, will be largely conservative Christian students. So if you're, you know, if you're studying radical feminism, you're not going to be exposed to what's at Hillsdale College unless you take a, you know, a long bicycle ride to get over there. Whereas imagine placing the civic centers, they're not, I wouldn't consider them to be replicas of Hillsdale College, although some of them might come closer to being like Hillsdale College than others. But for example, what you have at, you know, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, that is much more, that's much more ecumenical than, you know, than Hillsdale College. You have, you know, contemporary debates about pronouns, transgender politics, that kind of stuff, critical race theory, reparations. And so there's different emphases at different universities, you know, different programs. Some of them are more focused on like economic liberty and free markets, but some of them are much more, well, just what you would think when you took a humanities class 20, 30, 40 years ago, which is just the great books, the great ideas and things like that.
So you in your reporting it real clear, you said some warn against the natural temptation to hire faculty based on political beliefs and wage warfare against the woke machine and thereby risk becoming right wing echo chambers and alienating professors and students. The quote you have is from a Harvard historian who says the solution to politicization on the left is not politicization from the right. And I would agree with that. However, here's where I would come down. Let's talk about the faculty that is hired that is trusted with the civics education. And I guess my question would be, can they be trusted with the civics education?
Well, I think it's going to vary from program to program and from university to university and, dean to dean. And so some of these civics programs might end up looking a lot like Hillsdale College, basically kind of like Republican Party recruiting operations and training for, you know, basically for street level or, you know, or regulatory, legal and political engagement at a political level. But some of them, I think, are going to preserve the spirit of, you know, intellectual independence. And there'll be just to be a variety. I think in the same way that you can go to some English literature departments and study something that resembles literature.
Right.
And other linguistic departments is essentially will be, you know, you'll be essentially involved in a human rights tribunal prosecuting texts for crimes against humanity or for legitimizing crimes against humanity. So there's a variety of English departments. There's a variety, you know, math departments, business departments differ. Some of them are, you know, economics departments. Some of them are liberal. Some of them are conservative. You know, University of Chicago economics is known as conservative. I think Yale's, Harvard probably known as liberal. So and so I think you have that. You just have the natural variation that you have in academia already.
But John, are the universities like you focus a lot on North Carolina? Is this coming from a demand for that type of education from the students? Is it coming from a different place? What's the motivation for it?
Yeah, I mean, the motivation for it is that the modern academy has been essentially hijacked, or the humanities and the social sciences have been hijacked by professors who we would call them, you know, we could call them woke, or we could call them post-structuralist, or we can call them postmodernist. But they're not really, they're largely focused on critique, critiquing systems of power. And critiquing systems of power is not critiquing themselves. It's critiquing conservative politics or traditional West, or just Western, you know, the Western civilization, patriarchy, things like that. So they are in the business of critique. And there isn't really a vibrant tradition of studying Western literature, Western civilization from a non-hostile perspective, but from a more sympathetic perspective. Yeah. Now, you have to remember, though, that Western civilization is not a singular narrative. It is largely very embittered debates between philosophers, politicians, writers, poets, artists on what it means. You have to see it as a family squabble, to the point of people being disowned and estranged from each other. And the postmodernist tradition, or this, you know, critique tradition, including Marxism, is kind of part of the Western tradition. So the question really I think you're asking is, to what extent can you do Western civilization, and how would you incorporate Michel Foucault and, you know, Judith Butler, the queer theorist, and Karl Marx and a long tradition of Marxist philosophy into the Western tradition, because they are a part of the Western tradition in their own way. So the question is, are you conceiving of the Western tradition by exempting entire branches of intellectual and philosophical inquiry, or can you incorporate them?
Well, I think incorporation, I understand, you know, with all of this in higher education, I think I've said before, you don't want to teach the 1619 Project, teach the 1619 Project. But where is the other perspective, right? There should be another perspective, and there doesn't seem to be any.
That is my gut feeling and my instinct as well. Is my suspicion is that much of what the reason you hear this word indoctrination, that students are indoctrinated into social justice ideology, because they are taught critical race theory and queer theory and post-colonialist theory as a kind of catechism. There isn't really a critique of it. The critique,
that's right.
They get to do the critique of the other side, but no one gets to do a critique of them. They are sort of inviolable and sacrosanct. So what I think would be fascinating is to teach these subjects the way we teach Freud, or the way we teach Aristotle, or the way we teach Jung, or the way we teach, you know, any of a number of, you know, Wittgenstein. They're not taught as holy writ. They're not taught as gospel. They are critiqued, and we learn about, you know, Wittgenstein and his detractors, or Wittgenstein and his critics, modernity and its discontents, right? So we should also do Judith Butler, all the people who think Judith Butler is crazy. And we should also do Michel Foucault and all the people who think Michel Foucault has done a tremendous amount of damage. So that would be my preference, not to erase them from the historical record, but to pair them in a kind of dialectic with their critics.
I just don't know. Yeah, and I agree with you. I just don't know if you can have, like, could you have the modern day academia university professors handle both sides of that? I have, you know, every once in a while, well, quite often I have contributors to this show. My friend Scott Jennings comes to mind, who teach, you know, semesters at Harvard, and they'll do it with, Jennings is on the conservative side, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but they'll do it with someone else, you know, that was in the Obama administration or someone like that. So they're both teaching at the same time. And I think that could be very valuable. I mean, you got interesting exchanges, different perspectives. But you're not going to put two professors in a room for every class.
Yeah, you know, and I'm not on these campuses. I'm not in the classes. And I assume that some of this takes place to some degree. But I think that it's not a kind of living, vibrant tradition. I tend to think that it tends to be the exception. So
yeah, I think you're right.
The thing is that you're trying to get at, and I think that these critics get at, and I is... Are we going to just have two silos and two echo chambers living in parallel universes, or is there going to be any way to cross-fertilize? And they do have, you know, the civic centers do more than teach courses. They do K through 12 teacher workshops, trainings and courses, summer academies. They run high school essay contests. They have speaker series, lectures, conferences, roundtables, symposia. They have reading groups. So they they do engage in the public arena,
right,
in the marketplace of ideas. The question is, you know, to what extent and how vibrant that's going to be. Sorry, I have a cough.
No, you're fine.
Yeah, I hope you can kind of edit that out. But anyway.
Well, it's live radio, but I get it because I had a moment last week where I couldn't even breathe, so I get it. No, but yeah. You're right about that. Look, this is a fascinating topic, and I certainly wish you're addressing academia here, higher education, but I do think that more civics, this is a different investigation, different topic, but more civics in high school with a foundation might also play a role here, wouldn't it?
Yeah, so the civic centers, many of them are involved in K-12 teacher workshops, teacher training. And they run. They even have courses. You know, they may have a week long, or they have you know, a graduate level courses. And the idea is to reintroduce traditional modes of learning into the in high school, because once the students get to college, they really haven't been exposed to this. And their idea is that they need to be that the proper, you know, intellectual posture towards reality is to be in a posture of a relentless critique of systems of power, and systems of power tend to be defined by genitals and by skin complexion.
Yeah, right.
And they basically tend to be reduced to immutable characteristics.
Yes, you're right about that. John, awesome work here. I love the conversation. You have a great Christmas. Happy New Year. We'll have you back in 2025.
Thanks again.
All right, take care. That's awesome. Look, I want to talk about something here that's got a little crossover, and I addressed it earlier in the show. It's interesting because media, I think, plays a role in this as well, because you have so much one-sided journalism. And I'm very disappointed I can't talk about this, but I mentioned it yesterday. I was given some audio from a journalism class at the University of Missouri the day after the election. And the professor, I won't even give too many specifics here because this became controversial, but the professor in the class, here's a quote, "Democracy is so stupid. It's an idiotic system," right? And this was the day after the election. So I get the audio and I'm told that I can play it, but there was some, we'll just say, communication errors. And I didn't end up airing it yesterday. I did tell a story about it, but in all of this, I reached out to the dean of the journalism school of the University of Missouri, my alma mater, Bachelor of Journalism 1986, broadcast journalism. So I expressed, when I sent him an email, I said, look, you may want to comment on this because you should be aware of this. Then I told him that we're not going to air the audio because, again, the parent freaked out a little bit, understandably so, doesn't want his kid retaliated against if it gets out, all that. But the point of my conversation here is I had a really good conversation about media influence, left-wing media bias with the dean of the journalism school. And I was rather impressed with it. And he actually invited me to follow up with a visit to Columbia, and maybe we're going to sit down. I feel a little alienated from my journalism school. I graduated there. I was in Columbia from 83 until 96. I graduated 86, but I stayed and worked in radio. And there was a point in my, you know, career where I was invited to the J School in Columbia to, you know, sit in on classes, offer perspective. But then I started doing talk radio in 1992, and I was doing that in Columbia, Missouri. My politics were very known, and boy, the invites really, you know, they stopped. There was a kingmaker at Mizzou. For people who went through the broadcast sequence, you know who this guy is. Kent Collins was his name. And if you wanted a TV job in any market in America, if you sucked up to Kent Collins or if you did the right things, he was going to help you find that job if you were someone that he liked. Everybody liked this guy. Everybody loved this guy. He died a couple of years ago, and man, the accolades. I'm the guy that didn't like him. I'm the outlier here, which I often am. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that when Kent was a professor for me in 1985, I'm guessing, in a producing class, television producing class, he literally did not show up to class on a couple occasions and let us just all sit there because he had this independent consulting work that he was doing. Well, then my politics came into play, and he, you know, in my opinion, he's not here to defend himself, was completely unwilling to help me because of personal reasons and my politics. And I think that sucks, but I don't really care. I never wanted a TV career anyway. But my point is that even back then, I knew that there was bias that existed. But the conversation that I had today, and what I did was I shared with the dean of the journalism school this Vanity Fair piece that is out this week that Scott Jennings shared with me, because the owner of the LA Times reached out to Jennings over the summer because he had been on CNN and defending Trump and conservatives and said, hey, we want you to be a part of our editorial board. Scott's written columns at the LA Times for years, and he invited him, the owner, to be on the editorial board. That's actually going to take place in 2025. And I think that's encouraging because We haven't seen any shifts in media like that. That's a major shift to have a conservative and a pretty big name on a major newspaper, a major daily, which is certainly not right-wing, editorial board. So I guess I'm a little hopeful, and based on the conversation I had today, that maybe some of these things are going to at least be explored in the future, but I'll keep you posted on all that. I'm still disappointed I can't play the audio because, man, it's really gold. It really is, but I promise not to. Thank you, Nick Lowe and Lowe's Straight Jackets. Doing a little Christmas music, but we are going to do this right now.
Playback ready. Now, the audio cut of the day.
Okay, I think I'm going to do a little bit of a trifecta here and cover a couple of different topics. One is John Kennedy, and I've played this a couple of times, but my goodness, he's so good when it comes to being a wordsmith on the CR, which, by the way, we have a new continuing resolution. It's 116 pages. It's not 1,500 pages. He did say this before the new bill.
I saw what you saw. I mean, it's a multiple vehicle pileup. I knew as soon as I saw the bill it was going to be trouble. The thing was as big as a Costco.
Well, now it's not as big as a Costco, and they're going to maybe vote on it tonight. The second cut of the day is from earlier this year, but it's important today because the Wall Street Journal came up with some pretty good reporting talking about how many people covered up the mental deficiencies and physical deficiencies of this president. But let's not forget back in June when Joe Scarborough said this.
F you if you can't handle the truth. This version of Biden, intellectually, analytically, is the best Biden ever. Not a close second.
Come on.
Isn't that great?
It is Kenny Wallace. By the way, Kenny's going to be here on Monday. And then Dwayne Patterson guided me into this. Shame on me as a radio host for missing this yesterday. I almost kind of give credit here to Dick Durbin, not because he deserves a pay raise, but because he trolls Manu Raju.
CR members are giving themselves a pay raise. Do you guys deserve a pay raise?
Well, that's news to me. It's good news. You know, what has it been, 10 years or 14 years of no COLA, no change at all? And I think it's about time something's done.
You support getting giving
well,
yourself a pay raise.
Well, I don't know what it is. How would I not know about my areas?
But I mean, people look at the performance of Congress and say, why should we give them more money?
What about the media? Think about that for a second.
And we're not paid by public money.
I know you're not, but I mean, half of your listeners are not there anymore. You're still getting the same paycheck? What's going on?
Well, I mean, you're taxpayer money. I mean, you guys deserve a raise.
Let me tell you, I think that men and women serving in Congress, House and Senate, by and large, are hardworking, principled people and deserve to be adequately compensated. And no COLA for 10 years plus is inexcusable.
Okay, I don't really agree with any of that, but I do agree with trolling Manu Raju. I did love that. And by the way, let's not forget that some reporters out there are subsidized in national public radio and public television. Let's get rid of that in 2025.
Oh, man.
We'll talk tomorrow. Got a Reardon Roundtable at 3.
By the 5.
Get more at 971talk.com.